Hi, and welcome to episode number 178 of the weekly Google Cloud Platform podcast. I'm Mark, and I'm here with Mark as well. How are you doing, Mark?
I'm Mark. I'm also Mark. How are you, Mark?
I'm very well, Mark. How are you doing, Mark?
Mark is doing great. Wait, which Mark is? So I think I'll call myself Merch for now. I know that our accents are also very similar.
Of course.
So we don't want people to get mixed up.
Yes, yes, yes. But today we have Chris Anishik from the Linux Foundation, CTO of CNCF and VP of DevRel at the Linux Foundation, talking to us today all about the Linux Foundation, open source foundation, open source stuff, all good things.
Yeah, it was a great conversation that we had with him. I'd heard of the Linux Foundation. I think most people have heard of Linux, but there's a lot of open source projects out there, and it turns out they can sometimes be hard to manage.
Yep.
So I think it was really cool to hear what the foundation does, how it helps people out, and kind of like what that almost governing body provides for all these different communities.
Yeah, absolutely. And then I get to ask you a super interesting question where I ask you, how do I connect Cloud SQL to my serverless thingos?
Something very, very interesting, and we'll have an answer for you. But before we get to that,
cool things of the week. All right, what you got?
Well, first cool thing of the week, I'd like to call out a blog post written by one of our very own DAs, Felipe, who wrote a very, very cool and interesting little cover of how do you analyze rideshare data. So we're here in the Bay Area, where traffic is admittedly quite a disaster most of the time.
Nice.
And I think a lot of people are always wondering how long it'll take. And it turns out Uber actually released some public data sets, including how long it takes to get from certain destinations to other certain destinations, and then Felipe, who loves BigQuery,
he does,
decided to take all that, put it together, and show off a cool little Data Studio dashboard using the new BQ Business Intelligence Unit product.
Yep.
That basically makes it super quick to analyze and do actual BI dashboards. So the Medium post walks through kind of how he did it. It sets it up so you can take a look at more than just the Bay Area.
Yep.
And it calls out that we have a lot of cool public data sets for BigQuery. So I think that's really awesome.
That's cool. Awesome. I have one that I think is lots of fun, mainly because I like seeing machine learning agents do very silly things. There's a contest going on over at Unity called the Obstacle Tower Challenge. We are a sponsor of the prizes, which is lovely. But basically, the first iteration is now complete, in which teams are challenged to build an AI agent that has to navigate a procedurally generated obstacle course.
I can't navigate a procedurally generated obstacle course. How does an AI going to do it?
Through AI.
Oh, good point.
Yeah.
Hadn't thought about that.
Yeah, pretty much. So this is really cool. Yeah, so the first stage is a complete. We'll check out the details, which will be in the blog post. And soon, some teams are moving on to round two. They've received more than 2,000 entries from several hundred teams around the world.
Very cool.
So, yeah, it's a good one to watch.
Speaking of BigQuery before with Felipe's blog post, well, there's actually another cool blog post that came out a little while ago that talked about BigQuery's GIS tools, right?
Oh, yeah.
And these are things that, you know, are useful for calculating distances, kind of similar to the public data share that Uber had sent out. In this case, it turns out that even though we're talking about positions on Earth most of the time, you can actually take the same concepts and put them into astronomy terms.
Ooh.
So now we're able to look at huge public data sets of astronomy stuff and then take that and say, okay, well, let's use the facing coordinates to figure out where they are, gather all this big data, right? So now we've got all the power of kind of doing rapid big data analysis and comparing it to what could possibly be the biggest data set there is, space.
Space.
Super big.
Yep.
So I hear. People tell me. I haven't quite seen all of it myself.
I tried seeing it once. It took me. I got bored.
Is it? It's not worth it.
Okay. This is a lot of black stuff.
Mark review 1 out of 10. Yeah. Would not recommend it.
So finally for me, we have another blog post, GKE Sandbox, bringing defense in depth to your pods. At Cloud Next, we announced the GKE Sandbox in beta, which is a new feature of GKE. So if you feel that you need increased security and isolation of your containers, this might be a nice thing for you. It's based on gVisor, the open source container sandbox runtime. Basically, if you're running anything that potentially maybe is like slightly untrusted, like someone's providing you user code or you're running a multi-tenancy environment, you might want to try this out. It's pretty cool. We'll link to it in the blog post, but basically with a couple of extra annotations on your pod and a new type of thing inside your node pool, you're pretty much good to go. And then you can just continue running as you were before with just that extra layer of security. It's pretty sweet.
I think we're seeing a lot of kind of cool customizations that you can have now because, you know, there's one thing to be said about Kubernetes and then actually having a managed Kubernetes. But now it's like, how many little buttons and bells and whistles can I start to get on there?
Yeah,
this is just
cool.
Another one in the latest line.
Wonderful. I think that's everything.
Yeah, well, one more. Last but not least, okay. We do have a quick announcement for a great new public data center that just got launched.
Yes, very true.
Over in Japan, I believe in Osaka.
Yep.
So that brings us to, 20 regions worldwide?
That's a lot.
It's nice to see, right? So people can kind of choose when they're going to launch their services, where they want it, make sure they can kind of get that closest to the user as possible. Always a good thing to have.
Yep. And additional regions are coming soon, with Seoul, Salt Lake City, and Jakarta coming in the first half of 2020.
Very, very cool. And not that far off.
No. Well, why don't we go have a chat with Chris about all the open source things in the Linux Foundation?
Sounds good.
Okay, so super excited. We have my dear buddy, Chris Anishik, here joining us at CloudNext, CTO of CNCF and VP of DevRel at the Linux Foundation. How are you doing today, Chris?
Pretty good. It's nice to be in this small little house that we have here for the podcast booth.
Yes, our listeners can't see it, but it's an adorable little house.
It's adorable. It's comfy. It's cozy. Yeah, it makes me feel at home.
Exactly. Yeah.
Does your house look like a giant yellow plexiglass building?
Yeah.
I mean, well, if I moved, it took a while, it was expensive. I was like, hey.
But, you know, San Francisco rental prices. Before we get too ridiculous, do you want to tell us a little bit about who you are, what you do, like CNCF, Linux Foundation?
Yeah, sure. I mean, I basically have two roles. You know, I serve as VP of DevRel at all of Linux Foundation, which basically means, if people aren't familiar with the Linux Foundation, it's really not only about Linux anymore. We kind of are a family of foundations, right? We have things like the Node.js Foundation, or I guess it's the OpenJS Foundation. There's CNCF, which I helped start. There's the Automotive Linux Foundation, and so on. So I help basically run DevRel for across all these different foundations and make sure those communities of developers are very happy in those respective communities. But most of my day job these days is focused on really taking care of the CNCF technical community as CTO. So working with our independent technical board to make sure, you know, we're accepting wonderful projects into the community, and also making sure in general our projects and developers are super happy with the services that the foundation provides.
Now, that makes a lot of sense to me, except for one part.
Yeah.
You listed a lot of foundations there.
Yeah.
And a lot of different teams.
Yeah.
Let's start at the highest level.
Yeah.
What is the purpose of the Linux Foundation?
Cool. Very simple. So if you like go pull up like the bylaws and charter, the Linux Foundation is basically tasked to support and sustain the development of Linux.
Yep.
And open source software, and that open source software is very broad. So initially, Linux Foundation started out very focused on Linux, like Linus and Greg KH, the stable and stable maintainers, are employed as fellows and go hack on the kernel and make sure to take care of it. But eventually what happened as, you know, Linux grew and just in general open source grew, people were trying to find ways to kind of collaborate. And if you kind of look at it, there's a lot of different, you know, foundations out there. There's Apache, but their kind of motto is very much focused on the individual, and they kind of pretend companies don't exist. It's very individual community, and they're volunteer run, so there's no necessary services. The Linux Foundation is more of a professional services kind of foundation where we actually have people on staff that help with marketing, DevRel, you know, technical writing, all the stuff that like generally project maintainers don't like to do but are super useful for building community, running events. We're putting on KubeCon Barcelona in a month and a half soon, and you know, it's almost a 10,000 person event. That's a lot to put on, but actually super useful to build community. So we are kind of a full service professional staff organization. We've grown to support open source in all different industries. People would come to us and say like, you know, Toyota, hey, we want to do something in the automotive industry to bring open source to cars, to make things, you know, more efficient, innovative. Mm-hmm. We've worked at the telco industry, so we have Linux Foundation Networking. We cleaned up the mess with the IOGS fork and kind of merged those things into one organization. So we've kind of just grown through, Linux was one of the early open source projects, and people naturally came to our organization for help.
So you said, I mean, you said support, and then you've also listed like a wide variety of very interesting things that you do for open source projects as a whole. Is there any limit to that? Like, how does that get coordinated? Like, what happens
there? Yeah, so I mean, think about it. Each kind of sub-foundation kind of runs independently, right? They have their own, you could kind of think of it as like a business unit, their own P&L and potentially own staff, but the parent entity is the Linux Foundation. And so they kind of basically work with the community to figure out what they need. You know, I kind of have a saying that each open source project is unhappy in their own unique way, and you kind of have to work with them to figure out maybe you need infrastructure help. You know, a lot of the kind of the telco-focused foundations, they have like physical devices like routers and other crazy stuff. And so you kind of need a lab to kind of help them with. Others may just need help with, you know, we don't like technical writing. We kind of suck at it. Can you help us with that? So we do kind of a variety of things based on, you know, each, you know, type of project. But the LF is a fairly decently large organization. Like, we also host things like people forget letsencrypt.org. You know, everyone loves free SSL certs. You know, we basically bootstrap that and, you know, sustain it essentially as an organization.
So, I mean, that's still a long list of things that you do.
Yeah.
But it's really interesting when you mentioned that groups or open source groups will come to you and say, we need some help doing this.
Yep.
How does that group okay with working with, like, hey, let's just sign everything over to this foundation?
Yeah. So, I mean, think about it. Businesses inherently don't trust each other, right, in many ways, right? They feel like, oh, you're going to sue me for something, or, like, you know, unless there's some type of agreement or partnership. Well, by putting code and some level of IP, whether it's, you know, a trademark in a neutral place like we did with Kubernetes, we have this wonderful conformance program that everyone, you know, works with and ensures that they respect the project and are conformant. We set these types of things up for different organizations, for different industries, verticals, and projects. So having a neutral entity and the IP owned in a neutral way builds trust across these companies, and they decide together what they want to work on together, like what part of the industry maybe is commoditized at some layer or some interesting thing they kind of want to chase and work on together. So essentially neutrality builds trust and to me is a cornerstone of working together. So
you handle intercompany politics really well.
I will tell you the sad thing about this job. It unfortunately makes you respect politicians a little bit more, and that's painful.
Well, I mean, it highlights, right? Like, I'm sure there are, and there have been no shortage of, and probably currently are, plenty of conflicts between different people wanting to go different ways.
Different incentives.
And different people in the community who are just like, I don't know if I want to be governed by some higher authority that I didn't choose.
Yeah, or they compete at the market at some level, and someone's like, I want to go push this feature into something that I may sell. Yep. But, you know, at the end of the day, like, we very much focus on open source projects and making sure they are very healthy, sustained, and do everything to make sure they're healthy. Our members build products that compete in the market and go fight it out and figure out what they do. And so, like, we just, our whole goal, we kind of have this saying of projects, products, profits. So we sustain projects, our members build products, sell them, make profits, and that gets funneled back into the foundation.
How do people get involved? You know, if I've got a little project where I'm like, hey, I wrote a little like Go library and I want to put that in the Linux Foundation, I'm assuming that's not something I can do.
You know, there is a process. If you actually go to the Linux Foundation.org website, there's like propose a project and there's kind of like a little form. But, you know, recently we announced an initiative called communitybridge.org. It's so, if, you know, maybe you don't need a full-blown crazy foundation, but you may want to have support to maybe raise a little funding for like a meetup or an event, or you may want to do internships. So we kind of even have like a quote-unquote summer code as a service, for a lack of a better analogy, that could go all year round. So we have that available for people that are just individual projects and may not have like crazy backing or something.
Yeah, so I know recently, I believe you formed a coalition or whatever you want to call it for the Media Association or something.
The Academy Software Foundation.
That's the one I'm looking for.
Yeah, for the film industry, they don't love to collaborate either, but they've decided, you know what, maybe we should start not reinventing all these like color tools and other things and, you know, let's collaborate on the basis. Because what we're actually good at, stories and making movies, not actually the software to make those.
Now, how long did that take? What was that process like?
2+ years. You know, generally when these things start, they don't happen overnight. Usually one person that, you know, wants to champion open source in an organization has realized, like, this is stupid, we're reinventing the wheel all over the place, comes to us, or somehow we run into them at an event, and we just start the discussions. You know, the Linux Foundation has over 1,000 members worldwide, and so we just, like, reach out, oh, we know this person here, and then we kind of maybe host a little event or a meetup, and naturally people come together and write a mission, vision, and, you know, maybe a foundation is formed, or maybe it isn't. So sometimes it doesn't work out.
Yeah, I mean, that's not unique to the media. There's a lot of industries that still prefer very private, kind of closed door, not open conversations.
We're actually seeing other industries like pharma. They don't really like to talk to each other much either, and they're starting to dabble potentially in open source. And so we're just like into this area where, you know, we're one of the early pioneers of open source as an organization, and we essentially act as foundation as a service and bring communities together that want to collaborate on some specific piece of software.
What's the sell there? I mean, you're not selling anything because ultimately they're not paying, right? But like, how do you go to approach these people, or do they just come to you?
Just naturally come to us generally. So there's no like proactive reach out. It's usually the problems are actually coming from the businesses or people that have them. So we're not actively going out and say, you should do open source. Open source is great.
What sort of problems do you think they're trying to solve with open source?
Cross-company collaboration. Yeah. So generally there's some piece of the stack that they may want to commoditize, just like the Academy Software Foundation, all these like color tools that you know they've come up with, they're reinventing on their own, and their company policies to not allow them to easily collaborate, you know, with different organizations. So if you put the code in a foundation, there's usually an IP policy that everyone agrees to, a fair governance policy that everyone agrees to of how maintainers are elected and removed. And then all of a sudden, the companies could collaborate together in a fair way. It's like a sports match or something where, you know, everyone knows how the rules of hockey work and there's a referee or something. So let's go at it.
Do you also work in the other way where like you may go into companies and educate them about open source and like how they can work in that arena in a better way?
100%. Half my job is probably educating companies that are new to open source or don't understand how it works. It's actually my personal vision of like open source is sustained by convincing companies that open source is a good thing that they should contribute to, either by hiring maintainers or contributing to projects and just being involved in the communities. And we tend to live a little bit in a bubble sometimes in kind of like the Silicon Valley area. But if you go out to automotive companies or pharma companies, they haven't heard of Kubernetes, you know, bless their heart, but like, you know, it's like,
but I can't imagine that.
Open source is new to them. And so we do a lot of education. We have free resources, guides that we produce. I co-founded one initiative called the todogroup.org, where I used to run the open source office at Twitter, where we just produced a bunch of material of like how to contribute to open source, how to start a project, how to work with others, you know, what happens when things go wrong in open source. And so we just open sourced all these things available for companies to learn from and use.
Yeah, I know. I've definitely run into companies where I know members who would just be like, I can't even write feedback on a GitHub project because like legal or PR is not going to let me.
You have to go through the 11 circles of, you know, legal and PR
every time.
Every time for a patch or for everything. Yep.
But I think you do some legal services as well. Is that right?
Yeah, we do. We have legal staff and external counsel on trademarks and just legal advice in general. Like the Linux Foundation, by you join the organization, there's actually a legal network, and they have, I think, conferences twice a year where all these lawyers go into a room, which I want to avoid. But they talk to each other and they learn from each other. That's just kind of one benefit of being part of the organization. And usually a huge function of what we do is education of how open source works. You know,
actually, that's an interesting point. People can still be part of the foundation, but they don't necessarily have to open source code. They may just be there so that they can interact with open source code in a healthy
absolutely.
Way.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, all our projects don't require any form of membership. Right? Like all technical stuff, you just show up and contribute. You know, it's a duocracy, essentially. Like, if you show up, maybe you'll become a maintainer or something. The funding there is just to sustain us. Like, it's not cheap to put on KubeCon, you know, and it's, you know, or technical writers and so on. So that's kind of where the resources go to sustain the.
So that's a pretty helpful overview of why the Linux Foundation is important and some of the reasons that a lot of people might look at some of the projects there. But you mentioned that you've been spending a lot of time on CNCF.
Yeah. I was employee one with CNCF and the Open Container Initiative at the same time, which, if you remember, you know,
fun.
The wonderful container wars of days old. So
yep. Are we settled on that? Is that good? Like
OCI, we have containers. We have an image spec. We have a runtime spec. The team is actively working on a distribution spec. So, oh my God, it wouldn't be amazing if registries had the same kind of API out there and there wasn't any crazy issues where one didn't support multi-arc support or something. So they are like working together on those problems, and they've made a lot of progress. Almost every container runtime supports the OCI image and runtime spec at some level.
So I was going to say, you were like number one at CNCF. Where did that come from? What was the need? Why did that come about?
No, it's kind of an interesting story is, you know, I spent 5 years before joining Linux Foundation and Twitter working on open source infrastructure. So we had our containers, Mesos, before they were really cool. I quit that job after 5 years of startup. Good times, learned a lot. And then I was
living in the valley, right?
Yeah, exactly. I was like, I need a little time off after that. And then I had this wonderful conversation with the head of the Linux Foundation, Jim Zemlin, who called me. He's like, you know, Google has, you know, open source Kubernetes. You know, there's a bunch of folks that want to kind of build a standard on containers. Do you want to come help this? You have a lot of experience in open source and so on. It's great. You know, we're a nonprofit. It's going to be super easy. Just come do this. And, you know, so
it's basically a vacation.
Yeah. It's going to be easy. Oh, not for profit. Like, you get like 30 vacation days or something. It's going to be great. It turned out to be super, I don't say painful, but very rewarding. Like, you know, challenging is probably the better word, but bringing together competitors to like essentially collaborate and decide which parts of the stack essentially we actually want to commoditize or agree that we should standardize is a fun experiment, and it shows kind of the values. I don't think if we did not do OCI and help grow Kubernetes where it is today, it wouldn't have worked out without getting that agreement on, you know, container formats and so on. Otherwise, like if you go to a different cloud, you'd have to go like rebuild your containers or use another format. It would be a nightmare. So.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a very valuable point to why these things exist. Again, going back to why these foundations are kind of helping people.
And I think the other useful thing is, like, I do want to say, like, when, you know, Craig McLuckie and Sonic, you know, Sarah Novotny and some of the other folks that were very early involved with the foundation is we made a deliberate decision not to just call it, like, the Kubernetes Foundation. It was going to be the Cloud Native Computing Foundation to encompass more than just one specific project, you know, or technology. It was, like, to come up with a kind of, here's our mission. We want to spread Cloud Native, bring projects together that are very useful in the space. We don't necessarily want to anoint one technically project as a winner. We kind of want to build some specifications, and it worked out pretty well. I think we're a lot more successful with that mission than just specifically saying we're just the Kubernetes Foundation. So
you were employee number one at CNCF.
Yeah.
What does cloud native mean to you?
Oh my gosh.
Yeah. We ask the hard questions on this podcast.
No, it's great. So, you know, it's kind of funny is, you know, when we started the organization, it was like cloud native is all about services that live in containers that are orchestrated by some central process. And that was kind of like the originally thing that was baked into the charter. But recently we had this funny debate within the CNCF technical community of maybe we should write down the definition or update it. And so it's actually been updated. It's on GitHub. It's actually much longer than I like, but essentially encompasses that original definition, but it includes more things like service meshes, concept resiliency, and so on. So if I had my computer in front of me, I could read it, but
that's okay.
It is too long, but it is something that the community of, you know, we have hundreds of members, thousands of developers contributed that actually came up, agreed upon, and voted on it. It's translated into like Chinese, Japanese, Korean on GitHub.
Is that going to continue to grow, though? I mean, especially as the ecosystem kind of rapidly is right now exploding in every direction.
Yeah.
How is the foundation going to be able to kind of oversee a good chunk of that?
We're no longer one person anymore. There's a staff about...
That usually helps.
Yeah, exactly. There's a staff about 30 or so folks that work directly on CNCF full-time. We have a lovely booth here. I don't know if you swung by.
It's great.
That, yeah, exactly. It's very pretty. We have lots of stickers. So if you're into, like, you know, Fluentd, you know, ContainerD.
I have a few stickers
Envoy,
on my laptop.
I saw some podcast stickers that somehow ended up on the...
Strange. How about that? I don't know.
Exactly. We have a decent amount of staff now. So we have about a little over 30 projects now. And, you know, as we grow as an organization, we try to staff up appropriately. And part of our work is not only, you know, staffing the foundation, but also working with companies to convince them that, you know, if you're betting your business on Kubernetes, you know, maybe you should try to contribute some resources to translate the Kubernetes docs into Japanese or, you know, contribute in your own way. And a lot of companies actually need that, you know, education because they're, you know, very new to open source. You know, it's very surprising if you're just living in the Bay and sometimes you go talk to a bunch of crazy customers or, you know, people that are new to open source. There's lots of them. We're still kind of in the early days of people understanding open source, in my opinion.
Yeah, I mean it's not necessarily crazy. It's just different people at different levels of the stack and that's just where they're at, and that makes sense, right?
Yep.
So I mean that sounds good from like you can join this foundation, you can get this support. If you don't like it, you don't join. Very simple.
Or you could still always contribute code. Like if you want to fiscally support it, you're more than welcome to, but it's not a requirement by any means. But if you're building like Kubernetes conformant type things, then yeah, maybe you should support this organization because you're betting your business on it.
Have you run into any people who are actually like resisting the foundation?
It's more of an education, like, so like, what do you necessarily do? Or it's like, oh, I have this like Kubernetes distribution. Oh, there's a conformance program. Oh, it's run by CNCF. I had no idea that, you know, this existed. So it's more of just educating people and kind of what we do. We produce these kind of amazing annual reports. I don't know if you've seen them yet, but if you go to the CNCF website, go down there, find the latest annual report, kind of shows like the amount of events we put on, the amount of like, you know, diversity scholarships that we've done in an organization, the amount of contributions we've done as an organization. So we kind of just publish all that and try to educate people out there of kind of what the organization does and how they could kind of get involved.
Nice. Sounds like there's a lot of stuff that happens at the organizational level. If I'm just a lone developer typing away in my cube, what have you done for me lately? Like, do you know what I mean? Like, what does the CNCF and the Linux Foundation kind of do with the individual layer? Or is it just more like I'm helping you build stuff and that's cool?
It's a combination of everything on an individual level. It's like we've given out, I think last year, 300 plus diversity scholarships. You know, if you're an individual coming from wherever and like, hey, I want to attend my first, you know, KubeCon. So we've done a lot of that. Like, it's hard. Like from a Linux Foundation perspective, it's like, use letsencrypt.org. Do you think it's got free SSL
certs? That's true. That's very true.
Exactly. With the Community Bridge platform that we launched, now we offer like summer code as a service anytime for projects. And so you can go have an internship any time of the year instead of just a specific time. So I think as a politician, we have multiple constituents, right?
Oh, yes, I like that.
We have members, we have individuals, developers, and so we try to provide services for all different types of you know, constituents because they have different cares and needs. You know, back to my saying, like each open source project is unhappy in their own unique way, and we do our best to kind of work with different, you know, types of people, companies, and so on to address their needs.
what interesting trends are you seeing at the moment across open source? Are you seeing anything that's like changing the landscape over time?
I mean, I don't want to talk about the whole like open source licensing gate, you know, stuff going on with companies, you know, coming up with kind of bespoke anti-type, let's say cloud licenses. That, yep. I think it's just a long topic. But the thing that I see the most is new industries that you would not think would have anything to do with open source, you know, the automotive industry, the pharma industry, cities even are starting to want to collaborate and even share data amongst each other. So a lot of trend of like new industries that you typically would not expect to do anything with open source are starting to realize that we would like to collaborate potentially with each other, and we kind of want a fair, neutral place to do that. So we're getting approached a lot by these new industries, even like the gaming industry, giving back to our original meeting at GDC.
What has been the particularly challenging thing that you've been working on? Because I know, I'm guessing there's a lot. I mean, working with varying interests and various incentives.
I mean, I think it's sometimes difficult. You know, as an organization, we are still somewhat of a small non-for-profit, so we are kind of limited in resources in some ways when we kind of start new things. So, you know, recently I was working with Facebook on a project, a technology called GraphQL, solves a very interesting problem, and there was a large community of folks out there that wanted to see GraphQL in a neutral place, right? You know, and so it was a year plus project to kind of make that happen, you know, convince the right parties, work with lawyers, and eventually that was kind of done as like a side project for me. And now that the foundation's finally kind of formed, it could be properly staffed. So we kind of have this weird like bootstrapping problem where like, you know, someone will come to us with an idea and, you know, let's just work on this on my side and figure out what, you know, eventually I'll make it work, and then, you know, we'll get it staffed appropriately. So it's kind of we have a bit of a resource, you know, constraint type problem when it comes to new projects, because we are kind of fairly small compared to, you know, these wonderful billion-dollar companies that are all around me. So
what's on your wish list? I mean, like, what are you really hoping to see soon?
Like I said, my focus is CNCF, like keeping our projects, you know, happy, avoiding conflict as much as possible, and making sure that we continue to grow the diversity in our community. You know, infrastructure as a space tends to just not be as diverse as other parts of software, in my opinion. So we do our best to ensure that we get tons of diversity scholarships for a lot of our KubeCon-related events. And I mean, last year, I think we threw over $300,000 last year in diversity scholarship, which is the most of any open source foundation. And to continue to grow that, to make sure our community is inclusive and diverse, I think is super important and something that I'm personally passionate about at the Linux Foundation and CNCF.
So if I'm either a company or an individual and I want to get involved either with the Linux Foundation or CNCF, like, where should they go? What should they do?
I mean, generally, most people get involved at the project level. It's like, oh, I use GraphQL, I'm going to go contribute to that. Or, you know, I use Spinnaker, I'm going to go find that. And most of the times, a lot of these projects are just project first, and they just happen to live in a foundation that kind of holds the, you know, trademark or IP or, you know, whatever. So just go to the projects that you normally contribute to. You know, you may be surprised that they're part of the Linux Foundation. They have no specific idea.
So there's probably people who work on this stuff and have no idea what the foundation does or anything of that nature.
Yeah, we do our best to try to message, but, you know, our whole, you know, philosophy is to let the projects do what they're good at and try to stay out of the way. We don't like force crazy governance or anything. We're just basically kind of like referees and neutral holders of IP to ensure people behave, essentially. Yep. It's kind of, imagine like a sports match. It wouldn't be fun if you were playing in kind of a game and, you know, one team had an advantage or over another or something, and the referee wasn't really doing their job. And so we try to make sure the rules are fair and these organizations are supported.
If I'm a company or even like a group of people who are like, oh, I think we have a great project that would be a great fit somewhere. Is there like a focus
area? You go to linuxfoundation.org, you go to projects. I think there's like close to project is the name of the link. Go check it out there. You know, last year we hosted events that probably nearly had 35 or 40,000 people. Go to Open Source Summit. You know, we're doing one in August in San Diego.
Nice.
Go to KubeCon. We host a lot of different events out there. So that's one way to kind of get involved with the community. But go to the website. We have a lot of information.
Cool. Before we finish up, is there anything we haven't covered, something you want to make sure that the listeners know about before we get done?
No. I mean, a lot of times, you know, the simple thing is people get confused that, like, the Linux Foundation, obviously Linux is a big part of it, but we do a lot more than that. You know, a lot of people don't realize we support letsencrypt.org. We fix the Node IOGS, you know, things. Now that's actually OpenJS. So now the Node.js Foundation and the JSF / jQuery folks all merge into one happy entity. So just that we do a lot more than I think people realize. And so check out our website and kind of go to our projects page, and you'll be surprised what's actually on there.
Have you considered the tagline more than just
Linux?
You
know, I lost that war of like, maybe we should rename the foundation.
Can we just get some stickers, I think? Linux Foundation, more than just Linux.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. No, every time you get a free SSL cert, you know, send a little love to Linux Foundation. We help make that happen.
Well, thank you very much for that.
Thank you very much,
Chris. Thanks for the conversation. It's been fun.
Cheers.
Yeah, so that was a great conversation with Chris. Obviously, thanks so much, Chris, for coming in.
Indeed.
Super, super cool to hear. I didn't know much about all these open source foundations and, you know, kind of why they were so important in the world. And obviously, with all these different people kind of working together, I can see why they might need a little bit of support from the higher layer.
Absolutely. Definitely love that. Well, let's get stuck into the question of the week. What I want to know is, if I've got Cloud SQL, how do I connect that to my serverless thingos?
Well,
that's the technical term, by the way, thingos.
The thingos.
The thingos, right. Yeah.
See, here at Google, we have lots of thingos for you to use.
Yeah.
Well, if you're not using thingos, but instead you're using something like, oh, I don't know, the recently announced Cloud Run, pretty good offering, I think, for most people. It turns out it's becoming a lot easier to connect in these things. So traditionally, you might have something like, you know, opening up your SQL to public IP address, which is a fantastic idea, and everyone should do it.
Do not do that.
The sarcasm did not come across. Clearly, you know, there's a lot of security implications with opening up a database to the outside world. So oftentimes people don't want to do that. So in the case of Cloud Run or in the case of serverless offerings, it can be kind of tricky to understand, well, you can't just whitelist a few IPs or something like that. It's not as easy to connect. Well, thankfully, there's a cool blog post where Cloud Run talks about some recent additions they've made since the kind of the next open beta for everybody to try out. And one of them is just a very, really quick command line argument you post in called add Cloud SQL instances.
Oh, nice.
Couldn't be much easier. So if you're running Cloud Run on the kind of just hosted version, which is all the serverless, then you can kind of just add in that command line, you pass your Cloud SQL instance, and you're good to go. If you're running Cloud Run on Kubernetes, so you have a little bit more structure, and that's kind of the Knative aspect of it, then it's actually pretty easy to follow a different set of instructions, but you're adding a proxy in front of Cloud SQL. So you take that proxy, you connect to that instead, and you still kind of maintain your private Cloud SQL. So all the details are in the blog post. It's actually two lines, I think, if you want to add it to Cloud Run. So super, super easy, and I think that that'll open up a lot more access for people to run databases along with the serverless apps.
Nice. Very, very cool. All right, well, before we wrap up today, Mark, what are you up to? What are you doing? What cool things are you doing?
Well, I'm working on a lot of video projects, so hoping to come out and view some customers on the East Coast soon.
Oh, nice.
And just in general, you know, I try to live my life without moving as much as possible.
As much as possible? No arm waving, no leg shaking.
So far, so good. I'm hoping to record the podcast from my desk next time.
Oh,
that
nice.
That would be nice.
That would be not good.
Could I record it from my bed? That's really the question.
Actually, that's good. You'd have like really good audio quality because it's probably quite absorbent.
I hadn't actually thought about that, but now you're actually like, let me put the document together.
There you go.
This.
Yeah, anyway, cool. All right. What am I up to? Looks like I'll be speaking at Next Tokyo in July. So if you're in the region, please come by, say hello. August, I will be at the Open Source and Gaming Day, which is right before the Open Source North America Summit. I may or may not be speaking. I have a CFPN, but I'm on committee, so who knows? I don't know.
Can you vote for yourself in the committee?
I cannot vote for myself now.
You know what? That makes a lot of sense.
It does make a lot of sense.
Well, there was some kind of foundation to tell people how to run these. Oh, wait, we just talked about that.
Yep, exactly. That's exactly the foundation that is running the Open Source North America Summit.
Good tie-in. Good tie-in.
I like it. Thank you. Excellent. All right. Fantastic. Well, I think that wraps everything up.
Well, Mark, good to chat with you.
You too. Thank you for joining me on this episode of the podcast.
And we'll see you all next week.
See you all next week.